This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show!
You ready to talk pro wrestling?
I am.
Good, because I am too. So, we were asked by Carolyn to chat up the Bret Hart Montreal screwjob incident. She had several questions about it, and definitely couldn't answer them over the Skype. So, I mean over the Skype, over the Twitter. So I said we would talk about it this week.
And so here
of course
we are.
To do that. What was that?
Said, and here we are.
Yes, and of course to do that we had to watch Survivor Series 1997. And I know you rewatched it. What did you I haven't watched the pay-per-view, the entirety of the pay-per-view probably since 97. I've watched the screw job portion of it, or I've seen it many, many times in replays or whatever, but I haven't watched the whole event in a good 20 years. What did you think?
So the funny thing is I watched, I managed to get through all of it up to the last two matches, which were Stone Cold and Owen Hart and then the screw job. So I haven't watched both of those, but just like you said, I've seen this screw job recapped and replayed. The Steve Austin Owen Hart one was wicked short. It was like a 4 minute match.
It was terrible, almost like you had the messing around with first LaFon and Neidhart at the beginning of the match, and they all get sent to the back, and then Owen and Austin are in the ring for, like you said, like 4 minutes together. And then Austin hits a very lackluster stunner and gets the pin. I mean, it was such an anticlimactic match.
This whole pay-per-view, it was bad.
It was. Like, my general consensus was it was just bad. I mean, let's break it down real quick. I mean, real quick. You had seven matches total on the card. The opening match was a 4-on-4, and all the Survivor Series matches, by the way, were 4-on-4 matches. You had the New Age Outlaws and the Godwins against the Headbangers and the New Blackjacks. And what threw me off on this one was that the New Age Outlaws, I don't think they were called the New Age Outlaws when they were introduced, and they came out to the Godwins music.
Yeah, this was before they became a thing, really. Like, it was just starting, which is kind of odd. And, like, you know, this wasn't really my era. Like, I was not actively watching wrestling at this time.
Yeah.
It was, it was kind of just getting to the end of watching it and losing interest because of the direction things were going. But, so it was interesting going back because I've pretty much always known them. I mean, I knew, you know, Billy Gunn from the Smoking Guns, and I knew. Yeah. Road Dogg from his work with Jeff Jarrett, but like this was the beginning of the next segment of their career, and like I didn't know anything about this segment, and so it just really felt odd.
Yeah, and it was weird because first of all, I like the Godwins music at this time. It's a very just simple like fiddle, but it's not happy-go-lucky. It's pretty badass, actually. Pretty menacing music, but it's simple. So it was just weird hearing them come out to the Godwins music and not the Rome because they hadn't really established themselves yet. And then, like, the match itself was 15 minutes long, and it wasn't good.
Yeah, when there's an elimination that is an abdominal stretch pin.
Yeah.
That does not bode well for the whole match.
Yeah, that's how Bradshaw eliminated Henry Godwin. And then Barry Windham got pinned after a clothesline. Mm-hmm. And Mosh got eliminated after Billy Gunn reversed a bulldog. So essentially, Mosh went for a bulldog and Billy Gunn just reversed it to like a side suplex and pinned him. At least Phineas got pinned by their finisher. the stage dive, and then Road Dogg, Schoolboy Bradshaw, and Thrasher got pinned after a guillotine leg drop for the New Age Outlaws to be the survivors of the team. Wasn't very good. No. Wasn't very good at all.
It was so. I have a bigger point once we recap all these matches too to make with the shit quality of this too.
Yeah. Good. I can't wait to hear it. Next up, we have the Truth Commission, the Jackal, the Interrogator, Sniper, and Recon. Now,
so these guys come out, and I literally go, "What the fuck is this?" I looked up these guys and was like, "This is such just like an out of the blue." Like, I did not know these guys existed. And even though I didn't watch wrestling for so long, for me to not even know that somebody existed surprises me.
Okay, so the Truth Commission was – they're supposed to be like a South African militant group. Mm-hmm. And they were led by the Jackal, as you saw, Don Callis. And this would be the only time he actually dressed like them. Otherwise, like he after this, he kind of made his own look and it became a little bit different of a group. But anyways, so Sniper is a Canadian professional wrestler who was actually pretty big up in Canada, trained by the Eduardo Carpenter. And he was actually pretty big up in Canada, but that was about it. Recon was Bull Buchanan. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember him or not. He ended up teaming with Big Boss Man for a while. Then he became B Squared with John Cena for a short stint. Went to All Japan, went to Pro Wrestling Noah, retired from the ring in 2014. So, but yeah, that was Bull Buchanan, which at the time, he became Bull Buchanan after this incident. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so this was a 4-on-4 match against the Disciples of the Apocalypse, Cross, Chains, 8-Ball, and Skull. This match went about 10 minutes. Again, very, very lackluster. I mean, you had a pin in the first minute, I think, when Chains was eliminated. And then, near the end, all of a sudden, you had a sudden rapid succession of pins. But anyways, the Interrogator, a.k.a. Kurgan, was the sole survivor in that. And that was just a match.
Yeah, you could tell that whole group is – they're trying to get a monster over in WWE, and
right.
They have this big group to get the Interrogator over as a monster. And man, how many failed attempts do you have to have at getting a giant talent over?
They've been pushing Roman Reigns for 3 years, and in my opinion, without success. So I don't know what to tell you there. The best part of this match was the Jackal's work on commentary.
Yeah, he promptly got eliminated so he could go out and do commentary.
Well, he started doing commentary, got into the ring, was eliminated, came back out to finish commentary.
Yeah,
so
that was kind of funny. Yeah, to me, the Jackal just felt like a cheap Johnny Polo.
It definitely wasn't what he wanted. If you listen to Killing the Town with Cyrus and Storm, he talks about the character a lot and why it didn't work. And every because he didn't want to be a manager. He wanted to be a wrestler. Like, that's what he was. But he also figured, all right, this would be my foot in the door. And it didn't work out for him.
Yeah, he was not a large man, though. So, I mean, he did not fit in with that group.
Next up, and I had forgotten about this part of it. I'll talk about it in a second. But you had Team Canada, the British Bulldog, Jim Neidhart, Doug Furness, and Phil LaFon, which I knew Furness and LaFon were a tag team. I forgot about their short run as kind of like associates of the Hart Foundation. Mm-hmm. But I love the fact that in Team Canada, you have one Canadian.
Yeah.
And Phil LaFon. You got
an American, a British guy, and then another American.
Yeah, exactly. Against Team USA, Vader, Goldust, Mark Mero, with Sable, and I completely forgot. This was Steve Blackman's debut match in the WWE, his re-debut match in the WWE. And I completely forgot that he was introduced as a fan out of the audience on Monday Night Raw, and then that Sunday he was in the pay-per-view match. And if you watch right at the beginning, they talk about how Blackman, he's got a black belt in karate, but he's not a wrestler. He has no wrestling training. First thing he does when he comes in the ring, hits off the ropes perfectly and drops an elbow. You know, like the first thing he does is a basic wrestling move. But for a guy with no wrestling training, he shouldn't have been able to do it. Yeah, and then they protected him by having him get counted out because he didn't understand he had to get in the ring by a 10 count. Yeah.
Oh my god, this match, sadly enough, this match has maybe not at this point in time, but like the people in this match actually have like the most talent out of any of the Survivor Series matches. The problem is they're all just pretty much past their prime or not very good.
Right now or at the time?
At that time.
Well, okay, see, well, actually, I'm going to argue with you on that one, because Doug Furness and Phil LaFon were a phenomenal tag team at that time, and they were basically brought in, much like Vader, brought in, and then just not used properly at all.
Yeah, they weren't past their prime. I never cared about them, and I don't think anybody watching this that was a WWF fan really, like, you never bought them, you know?
No, just the way they were pushed, they were presented. But, I mean, if you watched All Japan where they were killing it, I mean, Doug Furness gave Vader an over-the-head belly-to-belly suplex in this match. I mean, that was impressive as shit. Vader was 400-plus pounds.
I actually missed that. I got to admit, I dozed off several times watching this over the course of several
months. I completely understand that happening. This whole pay-per-view just wasn't good. It just wasn't good at all.
Team Canada, I mean, Bulldog and Neidhart, they were both past their prime at that point. Furness and LaFon had no heat with them. Vader was past his prime. Goldust was in his what the fuck are they doing with him moment.
Yeah.
One of many of those throughout his career.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I would have said he was past his
Vader's
prime.
Vader's a baby face somehow.
Yeah, Goldust has had several primes throughout his career, which is pretty impressive. Yeah. But this is one of those moments where it's just like you don't know what they're doing with him. Probably one of the moments where Vince felt bitter about Dusty or something. I don't know. Mark Mero never was good in WWF.
You know, it's funny. I never cared for him in WCW, but near the end of his WCW run, you actually started seeing him. He looked better in the ring to me. Like, he was starting to use some high flying moves. He was starting to get in more matches with like the Luchadors and, I don't know, he just looked better, and then he left, and he came to WWE and just started sucking again. I don't know.
Yeah, see, I wanted him to be good in WWF because, I mean, I was a kid, but watching him in WCW, I liked him, but you were supposed to if you were a kid. He was a big baby face, you know?
Exactly.
But going back and watching, I stumbled across him in some random WCW pay-per-view, and yeah, he was not good. And he goes to WWF, and, you know, I mean, he looked good. He was, you know, but he just like he had no performance. I mean, he worked as the character Johnny B. Badd because of the crazy charisma, but you know, it doesn't translate to performance in the ring or anything like that. I don't know. I feel kind of bad that Bart Gunn got knocked out by Butterbean in the Brawl for All. I didn't feel so bad when Mark Mero got put in those kind of positions and got exposed.
Yeah, no, I didn't feel bad at all.
Who is the fourth on that team?
Vader, Goldust, Mark Mero, and Steve Blackman.
Yeah, Steve Blackman. And he just they made him work when they paired him with Al Snow and made it goofy, but that came down the road. But, I mean, he just was never a proper fit for wrestling.
I liked him with Al Snow. I actually thought
him
a lot.
Yeah, I wasn't watching actively at that time, but I've seen a lot of that stuff, and they did really well with it. You know, they took something, and he was always awkward and different, and they made it work. They paired him with somebody that got the best out of him and didn't put all the pressure of the spotlight just on him. You know, somebody helped him along. All right, so let's move on. What's the next terrible match?
Kane against Mankind.
Okay, so that match wasn't actually bad, but that was one of the, like, why are they making it impossible to see what the fuck's going on matches?
Like, yeah, I didn't understand
red lighting, and, I mean,
they were doing the weird red lighting, yeah. That when they, like, well, Sin Cara had weird lighting. I'd forgotten about Kane having the weird lighting when he first came in. This was really his first big singles match after his debut, the month prior at Hell in a Cell.
Yeah, and this, I mean, it wasn't an amazing match, and it was mostly just him beating the hell out of Mick Foley.
No, Mankind took a beating, went through table at the ring, one of the ring announcer tables.
This is, it's just a match where even though there wasn't a lot of spectacular about it, Mick Foley is just such a damn good performer that, you know, and I got respect for Kane, but like this match was one of the few spots in this pay-per-view that weren't bad. And it's because Mick Foley's he's such a good performer. He makes everything look compelling.
And honestly, with Kane, he's only been in the character for a month. I mean, he hasn't established, you know, he's not broken in. You know what I mean? He's not a well-oiled machine.
He was trying to transition over from being fake Diesel. You know, it takes time.
It's kind of like when you watch early Undertaker. And it's just – he's just very slow and methodical, but he's not doing some of his signature moves, and he's just choking guys a lot. And
yeah. It's funny. I came across him in WCW recently. I had never seen pre-Undertaker Mark Callis, and I came across him in WCW, and I was actually pretty impressed by him, you know, because I knew what early Undertaker was like. And
We were talking about that recently, correct?
I believe so, yeah.
And it was Capital Combat 90.
That's the one, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep, Capital Combat 90. Aaron and I just talked about that a few weeks ago. I did a blog about it, and he's like in the opening match. And he actually does a lot of the things that he would eventually do as The Undertaker.
Yep, yeah, except a little bit quicker because he wasn't going for the slow and methodical without
having developed it yet. Yeah.
Yep. All right, next match.
The Legion of Doom. Hawk and Animal with Ahmed Johnson and Ken Shamrock against the Nation of Domination, Rocky Maivia, Farooq, Kama Mustafa, and D'Lo Brown. Again, not a great match. The pre-show promo, Ken Shamrock talking, "I'm Ken Shamrock, I'm the world's dangerous man. I got a team together here of guys like the Road Warriors, guys who know what it's like to grow up in a bad neighborhood like Ahmed Johnson. And we're going to go out there, and we're gonna beat that Nation of Domination. Tell him, Hawk." And I'm like, Jesus. And then Hawk, you know, "Well." And then Hawk cuts a Hawk promo, which I popped for. And, yeah.
The only good thing about that team is Legion of Doom, and they're past their prime at that point. But
yeah, except Hawk got eliminated in the first 2 minutes of the match.
Yeah, which was stupid. I mean, oh my God. But seriously, that's a team full of guys who are going to legit injure somebody in the match. So I guess you might want to move them quickly.
Yeah, so Hawk gets eliminated in the first 2 minutes, and then Animal gets eliminated by countout because the New Age Outlaws came out and he chased them. He chased after them because they had on their spiked shoulder pads. And So ultimately it comes down to Ken Shamrock against D'Lo Brown and Rocky Maivia, and he taps them both with the ankle lock and becomes the sole survivor. And it was just...
Yeah. So to me, the only thing interesting about this match, and this is just kind of in the flow of things, like this match isn't critical in any way, shape, or form, but... you see, and throughout the pay-per-view, and I'll touch on this a little bit more in a minute once we finish recapping, but you see a lot of guys that are just before the big shift in their career that makes them huge superstars, and that's where Rock is right here. Is, you know, he's gone from he's still Rocky Maivia.
Rocky Maivia. He's a heel. He's starting to kind of address himself as the Rock.
Yeah, because you go back and watch this without knowing exactly where the standings of people were here, and you probably assume The Rock is going to win this match, but Ken Shamrock was the guy getting the big push at that time. So that was that was the only thing of interest in this match at all to me, is just knowing that was kind of in that trajectory
transition
of his career, transition to where he becomes one of the biggest superstars ever.
Well, not too long after this is when they kicked Farooq out of the Nation.
Mm-hmm. Which is one of the best moves for him. Got rid of that, you know, stupid gimmick and got him on to being Ron Simmons again.
Yes, and then they became an acolyte, and you're like, oh, but then they became the APA, and you were like, yeah. And they had that music that when their music kicked on, I was like, oh, someone's getting their ass whipped.
Yep.
And then we have an Intercontinental Title Championship, and we kind of addressed that earlier, Steve Austin against Owen Hart.
This should have been the best match in the card, and instead it's a piece of shit.
Yeah, yeah, it wasn't entertaining. And then the final match of the night, Shawn Michaels against Bret Hart for the WWE Championship. We all know how that ended. I hadn't watched the match in so long. Like, I remember them brawling before the match. It was a lot longer than I remember. They brawled for a good 10 minutes before they actually got in the ring.
That explains why the match time was only 12 minutes.
Yeah, and then once they got in the ring and they rang the bell, they went, like you said, they went like another 12 minutes before the whole controversy. And I'm so used to watching the aftermath, you know, him spitting on McMahon, him, you know, slamming the monitors around and everything like that, seeing all that footage. I forgot that the pay-per-view ends very quickly. Like, they go off the air very quickly. Excuse me. Anyways, yeah. So, I mean, that was the pay-per-view. As a whole, the best match on the card was Shawn against Bret, in my opinion.
I'm going to finish watching this tonight, too, once we finish this up. But, It's got to be. I mean, you got two great performers in the match before that they fuck over with a 4-minute match. But Shawn and Bret, that's one of the things, like, going back and watching Bret Hart wrestle any match, like, he just executes everything so well that it's like I had picked up a couple of old Ring of Honor DVDs that was like a just compilation of various matches, you know, and seeing an old Daniel Bryan match, and it was against Spanky, who would
Brian Kendrick.
Yeah, Brian Kendrick. Is he still in WWE?
He is a 205 Live competitor. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. So they had a match, and man, Daniel Bryan just executed everything perfectly. Like, he was great. And that's how it is watching Bret Hart, where he just, like, everything he did so crisply, so well. He sold everything so well, didn't oversell stuff, but sold it well, and all that stuff. And, you know, I mean, Shawn Michaels was a great performer, too, as much as I despised him at this time.
For those of you who don't know, Paul is a tremendously huge Bret Hart fan.
Yeah, you may not realize that. but I, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm a big Bret Hart fan because he's the guy. I mean, that's like my childhood, you know, I was a big Hulk Hogan fan, but like, it wasn't that long after I started watching wrestling that Hulk Hogan left WWF for WCW. And you know, Bret Hart was kind of, you know, as a kid, like, I shifted my focus to Bret Hart. So, I mean, he's always going to be that guy who has a place in my heart, but that's the type of wrestler that even now as an adult, with having a better understanding of everything and, you know, knowing what a good performance is, like, what made me love him is what makes me love guys like Daniel Bryan and, you know, all the guys that go out there and they do their job so well. And they may not always be the most charismatic guys. Like, Daniel Bryan, he got people to buy into him so big, and it wasn't because he was great on the mic, because Daniel Bryan was not great on the mic. He was okay on the mic.
But,
like, he was not great on the mic. Like, he sounded awkward on there so often, but it didn't matter because he was genuine and he worked his ass off, and you knew that, you know? So, I mean, he didn't have to talk to get the whole arena chanting yes for him. And that's, you know, that's how Bret Hart was. You know, he did his job so well, and you knew he was genuine about what he was doing. So he, you know, I mean, that's where his following came from people. Didn't take the charisma of a guy like Shawn Michaels, who was also a great performer, and he had, you know, a charisma and a showmanship that was different than what Bret Hart had. But, I mean, he can get on a mic and do a lot better. But honestly, that's a big part of why I dislike Shawn Michaels, is what he did with that. I couldn't stand the shit he did with Triple H and Degeneration X and all that stuff. Like, I just...
Well, I mean, if you look at this show, this pay-per-view, Shawn Michaels is, within 6 months, is gone for 4.5 years. You know, because of the back injury at the Royal Rumble, and then he loses the belt to Austin at the pay-per-view, and he's gone for 4 years, you know, 4.5 years. And then Bret Hart obviously goes to WCW, and I'm not going to say his career ended, but, I mean, they didn't know how to use Bret Hart.
Nope.
You know, and, you know, Bulldog was gone, Neidhart was gone after this. First and LaFon quickly were gone after this, not too long after. They stopped running Canada as much. They were running Canada a ton. I have I can't remember exactly, but I think they did 19 TVs and like 3 pay-per-views in Canada or something around this, you know, this in 97, which if you think about it, you know, 12 pay-per-views a year, a quarter of them are in Canada, and then like 19 TVs a year out of 52 are in Canada, I think, this year. So they were running Canada a lot. They stopped running Canada a lot. So, I mean, a lot changed in WWE after this pay-per-view. And honestly, for me, like Shawn Michaels, I look back at the Attitude Era, and it's kind of like when I look back at WCW at that time when I was watching it, how old I was then. It was cool. I was into it. But now it didn't age well. Mm-mm. And when I think of Shawn Michaels, I prefer to think of Shawn Michaels like the last few years of his career, where every match was basically – you know, he was going out there and killing it and having fantastic matches.
Yeah, and when he cleaned himself up as a person, too. And that's a big problem that I always have. He was a fucking junkie at this time.
Yeah. And, yes, basically, yeah. And after this, until he got himself cleaned up. But, yeah, once he got himself cleaned up as a person, their later antics, like the PG era of DX, that was more like, you know, dad humor stuff. I thought that was funny.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a big problem with Bret Hart at this time, and it's because the way he was portrayed for like the last year of his career, basically since he lost the title to Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 12, so like the last year and a half in WWE, he had was a whiner, was just a whiny whiner, yeah. Whine ass.
And it was built him as a you know, strong as a heel because he got under your skin, which.
But that was the thing. He wasn't a heel. Well, he okay. He wasn't a heel in the traditional sense because he was still a babyface in Canada and a heel in the United States, which that was pretty – I mean, it was genius how they pulled that off. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Absolutely genius how they pulled that off.
When you just said he wasn't a heel in the traditional sense. This was when the traditional sense of everything went out the window.
Oh, no, you're right, because Austin, who should have been a heel, was a babyface. And yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But I just – I don't know. I hated the way he was portrayed, but it wasn't he's such a whiner, I want to see him get his ass kicked. It was like, I just want to change the channel.
Yeah, I don't think it was done well, and that's what drove me out of watching wrestling along with some other – like, I did not like the sexual content, the growing sexual content, and I didn't like the crassness of the Attitude Era, which was starting to show its face here, but they took my favorite wrestler, you know, my hero who I liked – him because of the character, like not character like his and his character as a, you know, he's the hitman, but his character as a person. That's why I liked Bret Hart, and they took a shit on that, and they didn't even do it to good effect.
No, so, they didn't.
So here's a point that I wanted to make looking at all the people that are involved in this pay-per-view.
Okay.
If you had to go back to, like, what is the root cause that led to this, the screw job? What would it be? And I would say that the root cause is that Vince couldn't pay Bret.
Money. Yeah. Money.
So
I think it's money.
Yeah. Vince couldn't pay Bret the deal they already had made. Yep. Business was struggling. That's all understandable. Business is struggling. But Vince couldn't pay Bret. Okay. Let's look at who is on this pay-per-view. There's a lot of people here, okay? Mm-hmm. I have three categories here. The first category I'm going to read you is people who were either bad or essentially inconsequential in the grander scheme of things.
Okay.
Henry Godwin, Phineas Godwin, Mosh, Thrasher, Jackal, Interrogator, Sniper, Recon. Now, whichever one became Bull Buchanan, you could say he had more you know, maybe he doesn't belong in that list, but I don't know how big Bull Buchanan was because I didn't watch during that.
Nah, he wasn't huge by any means.
Okay, so I'm still going to say he's inconsequential then.
Yeah.
Chains, 8-Ball, and Skull, who they did a little bit of other stuff, but still, I had to look it up to remember what else they did. Doug Furness, Phil LaFon. They may have been bigger outside of WWF, but that doesn't really count here. Mm-hmm. Mark Mero, who, Jesus.
move on.
I put Steve Blackman on this list, but I think that I think in the bigger scheme of things, he may have been a little consequential. You watched at that time. Like, does what he did with Al Snow still have an impact right now?
I think some of the funnier things that he did with Al Snow do. Of course, I think the biggest memory people have is his match with Shane McMahon, where Shane fell off the Titantron and then Blackman jumped off with the elbow drop in the hardcore match they had.
So Steve Blackman might – like, he may have done more than I really kind of realized. And, like, you kind of –
but he wasn't around for a bit – like, few years. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't around a long time.
So, yeah, he's straddling the fence there of being inconsequential. Ahmed mm-hmm. Johnson.
Yeah.
Ken Shamrock, which I know you can argue otherwise, but I can't – looking back and watching Ken Shamrock – it feels like watching somebody that, like, you liked at the time, but then later something horrible came out about. Like, just something does not feel right about Ken Shamrock ever in WWF. And I liked him at the time, and I wanted him to go over, and they tried to put him over.
Yes.
But, like, you go back and watch him now, and you're just like, this doesn't feel right. Like, they just – it feels like they're pushing something wrong.
I think Shamrock's best time in the Fed was his feud with Owen Hart.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because he was wrestling Owen, and Owen was, in my opinion, better than Brett. So
it's like, I don't know, it's like they were pushing a bully as a baby face or something like that. Like, it just, something was not right about it. Like, you look at this, you're like, this is not right. They're doing something that is just, like, morally wrong here with Ken Shamrock.
Well,
I don't know.
No, and I get what you're saying there, because you have a guy like Shamrock, his big push is his MMA background. He's the, you know, ABC declared him the world's most dangerous man, and he's coming in there, but he excuse me, he's coming in there as being put over as a badass, as a guy who's going to beat people up, and that's what he likes to do, is beat people up. That's a bad guy. That's a bully, like you said. Yeah. And yet they were pushing him as a face. I think that's probably why it didn't work.
Yeah, yeah. It just doesn't work. And D'Lo Brown, I put on that list. I know he is a good performer, but yeah. I think still you look at the bigger picture and, like, was he really consequential, or was he just always a good hand that was around?
I want to see where you're going with this.
So yeah, some of these, like I said, you would have better insight on them than I do. Okay, now I'm mm-hmm. going to give you a list of guys who were past their prime. Crush, I think he had a bigger impact overall, so I don't think he belongs on the other list because he was part of Demolition. Mm-hmm. Kona Crush was a big thing for a long time. But at this point, like, he's definitely past his prime. DOA was Bulldog, Neidhart, both past their prime. Barry Windham, past his prime.
Hard for you to say that.
It's true. Like, he was used like shit in that character and everything else they used him for. They even talked about that on the Pritchard show. I was like, yeah, like this. I knew Barry more from this than from, like, the other stuff he did before. So then, like, kind of learning the other stuff down the road, be like, wow, they did that with that guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Hawk and Animal past their prime.
Yep.
And is that all? I thought I had somebody else on there. Oh, Vader, well past his prime, and they never used him well either, but he was definitely past his prime. So those are all the guys that were past their prime. So you add those two categories up, it's the majority of everybody on this show is, you know, they're either like, they're just a guy at this point because they're past when they really mattered, or they just never really mattered. So then you have other guys that go on to much bigger things. Billy Gunn and Road Dogg, you know, we mentioned New Age Outlaws. Like, they got big.
Yeah, you think?
Yeah, Bradshaw, you know, going on to be JBL and, you know, Acolyte Protection Agency. Like, he was huge after this, you know. I skipped one. This isn't really past his prime, but I mentioned this. Goldust was just in a what-the-fuck mode. Like,
he was
pointless at that time. Yeah.
He was in limbo.
Kane was at the beginning of a big career. Mm-hmm. Mankind was in the midst of just his great career. Mm-hmm. Rocky, The Rock, like, this was before he hit even the beginning of his pinnacle. Farouk would go on to be Ron Simmons again, and what he did in the APA, I think, was a resurgence to his career, because he had a big career before this too. So if it wasn't for APA, I would say he was past his prime. Kama went on to be at least really popular as the Godfather.
Yep.
Steve Austin was in the midst of his career, and this was
he was rocketing upwards.
Yeah. Owen Hart was still in his prime. I don't think he ever reached the pinnacle he should have reached.
No, God, no. He should have been WWE champion.
Yeah, and then Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart, obviously, they were both huge superstars. And even though, as we mentioned, Bret left here to go to WCW and just never got used right there, like, that's what hurts so much about this being such an abrupt ending to things, is that he should have been able to do so much more, and he got it stolen from him by some bad choices on multiple people's part, some unfortunate circumstances.
Yeah.
But so my point in all this, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26 guys that don't really fucking matter on this card. You have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 guys that either do matter at this point or are going on to being bigger. How the fuck could Vince not find the money to fucking pay Bret? Like, did he really need to have DOA and Los Boricuas and the Truth Commission and, like, all the – how much do you think he paid these fucking MMA guys that didn't do shit?
Let me break it down for you like this. Maybe this will help you understand a little bit. If you're booking an independent show and you have a $2,000 budget and you spend $1,500 on your headliner, now you're left with $500 to spend on the rest of the undercard. So your show's going to suck. And if your headliner can't draw and bring the people in or gets injured or something happens, you're screwed. If you spend $2,000 and you spread it out over the entire card, you're going to have a good card from top to bottom. And I think that's kind of half to how you look at it.
And that makes sense. Like, I don't disagree with the business reasons behind.
Yeah.
Business was struggling. Money. He wanted, like, Vince wanted Bret to be able to go get the money he deserved.
I think the other thing as well is it's maybe not Bret wasn't worth the money or Vince didn't have the money for Bret. I think Bret was going to cost Vince more money than he was worth only because where he wanted to go with the product was with Steve Austin and the Attitude Era that they went with, not with the wholesome family Bret Hart era that they were getting out of. And I think that would have been a problem. And kind of like how you stopped watching WWE because of the Attitude Era, do you think Bret would have fit in that at all?
No. Yeah, and that's true too. He wouldn't have fit in with
that. And now you're paying a guy more than you're paying anyone else to – where's he going to be on the card?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I didn't like what they did with Bret for the year leading up to this either. So, I mean, that all makes sense, of course. But, you know, when you boil it down to, like, what was the first root cause, and it was Vince saying, Bret, I can't pay you this deal, basically.
It was –
but then the way events transpired after that got shadier and shadier. And the reason this happened is because Vince was afraid – that Bret was going to walk out with the belt because other people had done that to him. But what was Bret all built on? Bret was all built on respect for the fucking business.
Yep.
So, yes, and it's a risk, but it could have been handled differently. And because of how it was handled, and, you know, you can argue both sides of the coin. Like, I mean, I heard, you know, when they talked about it on the Pritchard show, and Bret, you know, Bruce just said, fuck Bret. Like, they should have done even worse to him. Like, I get protecting the business, and I get all the different aspects of it that kind of caused it. It's just unfortunate, because if little things were handled differently, the trajectory would have been different. Mm-hmm. The bigger picture of what happened with this basically leading to the end of Bret's career at the hands of that douchebag piece of shit Goldberg.
That sidekick to the head, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it was little things causing a snowball rolling downhill, and then unfortunate just circumstances that were accidents. You know, I mean,
I think what you'll see if you look back,
him getting kicked in the head may not be an accident. It may have been Goldberg was shit at his job. But how many shit guys did Brett wrestle? And if that didn't happen, and then it happens with Goldberg, and it's massive and almost cost him his life.
I think if you look at it, Vince re-signing Brett for that giant contract that he couldn't afford was probably a panic result of Vince, like, if I don't have Bret Hart, I don't have anybody. If I don't have Bret Hart, I can't do this. And then I guess when he starts to see, hey, I can do this without Brett, and then ultimately I can't afford Brett, you know, there's people that said – there's been the conspiracy theory that I've read a lot is that the Montreal screw job was essentially it was a work, and it was a work to help Brett get the, you know, get more money out of WCW and to get the money he needed. And then Brett would come back to WWE after that contract because he got his big payday in WCW. But then Owen died, and that widened the gap, if you will, in the relationship between Brett and the WWE, and that's why he never came back. And then, of course, ultimately he has his injury from Goldberg, which ended everything for him for the longest time. I mean, obviously, if you followed Brett's career, you know he came back in 2010 to WWE. He eventually somehow won the United States Championship for Miz. He was involved in a 10-man tag at SummerSlam. He had that match with Vince at WrestleMania. So, I mean, Brett came back and actually wrestled a few matches.
Yeah, that was cool to see. Like, I'm glad to see that because that did allow some kind of closure for me as a Brett fan, seeing him, you know, come back and smooth things over and you know, like I
think ultimately, you know, if you were a Bret Hart fan, I was a Bret Hart fan. I loved Bret Hart when he was in the Hart Foundation with Neidhart. I loved it when he first broke out as a singles run. I mean, still one of the best matches I've ever seen live was Bret against Mr. Perfect in Portland, Maine in 1989, when Bret was actually technically still a tag team at that time, but him and Neidhart had singles matches that night. So, I mean, Bret's had some of the best matches I've ever seen. So to see that his career ended the way it did, I mean, it wasn't enjoyable as a Brett fan. And yes, you did not get the Bret Hart of old 2010 going forward when he had that last run in the WWE, but you saw a popular Bret Hart, you saw a good guy Bret Hart, you got, like you said, closure, you got nostalgia, you got your hero back again.
Yeah, exactly. It allowed it to, to, you know, get back to Brett being Brett and, you know, getting the good things again. So over time, you know, I was working my way out of wrestling by this point anyways because I was unhappy with the product. Like, it was losing its entertainment value to me. I didn't like what it was doing. So this was just like a big nail in the coffin for me as a wrestling fan for many years. And then, you know, of course, going back and I knew it happened. Of course, it's like, you know, you find out about stuff so without watching. When you're a big fan of anybody or like WrestleMania 12, like everybody talks about how great the Iron Man match was. I have never watched that again because it's not just that Brett lost. That he got cheated by the rules because it's wrestling. So rules don't really matter, of course.
Right.
And it was a great twist at the end and all that. And, as an adult knowing how things really work in wrestling, it makes sense to do that. But, as the kid watching, and that was my first ever pay-per-view and I was so excited and to see him literally leave as the champion in a draw. And I felt great about it. And then to get fucked. Because that's what that was. He had Shawn in the sharpshooter. If that was built into the rules, he doesn't let go of the sharpshooter and he wins the match.
Yeah.
But instead, and then as an adult, to hear the stories about how Shawn told the ref to tell Brett to get the fuck out of his ring.
That was Brett's book. You know, Shawn's book has a different thing, but
yeah. Well, since Shawn was a junkie at that time, I don't put much faith in his opinion. So. I don't know. The character of Shawn added into it is what makes me just get even more irritated by the whole thing. You know, I'm glad to see that Shawn cleaned up his act and had such a great run later, but I can't have respect for that period of Shawn's career because he got all these things that, he could perform, but his character wasn't earning them. And on top of that, like, as much as they took the belt off of Brett to give to Shawn, when did the he lost his smile thing happen? Was that before this or after this?
Oh, he lost his smile before this.
Okay, so he already showed
he had lost his smile in February of that of 97, actually.
Yeah, so he like when he did that, he showed he was unreliable.
Yeah,
and you know they talked about that in depth on the Pritchard Show too, and he told them he was injured, but then he goes out there and cuts a promo about how he lost his smile.
Yep,
and he just didn't want to be doing it anymore. And so they take the belt off of Brett this way because they're afraid of Brett screwing them and give it to the guy who, like, literally already screwed them.
Right.
Left them high and dry. So, I don't know. This whole era is just a big mess for me. And I think, like, it was a rough transition for them from what wrestling was into the Attitude Era. As mm-hmm. much as I don't like the Attitude Era, it was successful. And it was it's what
it gave the WWE what they needed. It gave them ratings. It gave them income. It made them be able to spread and grow as a company. It was definitely a giant boon in wrestling, not just for them, but for ECW, for WCW. I mean, if you think about it, at that time, every week, if you combine the ratings of Nitro and Raw, you're looking at 10 million people every week, practically, or better.
Yeah,
around 8 to 10 every week watching wrestling, and now. If you combine the ratings of like Raw and Impact, it's, 4 million. I mean, 3 million. It's just, maybe we'll have another boon in wrestling. Maybe we won't. I mean, it seems like it's been a long time since the last big one. So maybe we're due. But another thing to consider at this time is Brett, like you're saying, was morally against what was going on mm-hmm. with this expansion of the Attitude Era. So, it's hard, I mean, and that was the other reason why he had issues with Shawn Michaels. We've seen they were friends, and then we've seen that they definitely had their issues with each other. And, Brett didn't want to lose to Shawn. Shawn didn't want to lose to Brett, allegedly. I mean, ultimately, though, we have 5 questions we were asked, so we should get to them.
Okay, before those 5 questions, this last thing I'll say is if they would have just had Brett drop the belt to somebody else, they would have avoided all this, and then it would be completely different feelings about everything. And I know there's talk about all that, whatever, and there's reasons and all that.
And I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you, but at the same time, if you're a promoter and this is your employee and you tell them that they need to do this, then they that's what they need to do.
Yeah,
and I think that's what it was.
Is that how things worked with Shawn, though? Was Shawn doing what he was told to do?
Well, and I think that's what the big issue was with at that time. It wasn't like it is now. At that time, what you did if you were leaving the territory, you did the honors on the way out. If you were getting done, you did what the promoter told you to do, and you did what you call do business. And Brett didn't want to do business. And so back in the day, when someone would want to do business, you beat them up, beat the shit out of them. And that was the end of it. And you blackballed them. They couldn't do that because allegedly Brett had creative control in his contract. So, I mean, I don't know. I can't speak for why Vince did what he did. We just know it happened.
Yeah.
And the first question is, did HBK know this was going to happen? He broke character. The long and the short of it is yes. For 13 years, he denied knowing it was going to happen. He denied knowing anything about it. But yeah, he did. He knew. Very few people knew. Earl Hebner, Triple H, Vince McMahon, Gerald Briscoe, and Shawn, of course. As far as I know from everything I've read or reports or documentaries, whatever, those are the only 6 people that knew what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And Pat Patterson was hurt because he didn't know. You watch Michael's reaction after the match and all that footage. You watch his reaction in the locker room from the Hitman Hart Wrestling with Shadows footage. Great actor, great liar. Shawn Michaels knew it was going to happen. Number 2 is, what's the whole story? It's kind of a very open-ended question. I feel like we've kind of answered that.
Yeah, we've answered a lot of it, but I mean, if you're just talking about why they did the screw job, it's because we just said that Brett didn't want to do the job for Shawn because of Shawn's character, and Vince felt it was the best thing to do. Because, like I said, I think a big part of it is Vince was scared of getting screwed by Brett leaving with the title because that had happened to him. You know, Alundra Blaze, of all people, took the title, and she even said that she regretted doing that.
Right.
Of course, you know, Vince didn't mind so much when Ric Flair brought his title in, though, did he?
Well, yeah, exactly. I think it was all panic mode for Vince, you know, and as far as, is Brett going to do this? Is he not going to do it? WCW is breathing down our neck. You know, we're losing, you know, we're losing guys to them. They're gaining on us. You know, people are jumping there left and right, you know, and they've been losing their big stars, and now they're losing Brett, and he doesn't want the title to go on TV. And I think it was all a big panic, and probably people in his ears telling him, you know, hey, you can't let him do this. You can't let him walk out of here with this, with the belt tonight. And, you know, you read one thing where it says Brett agreed to drop the title in the ring, or to hand go out on Raw the next day and surrender the title to Vince. And then you read something else that's saying, like, he still had 4 weeks left on his contract with WWE. He could have done the December pay-per-view in Springfield, Massachusetts, and lost the belt to somebody. Allegedly, he said he'd do that. You know, and then there's the other thing that said he just didn't want to lose in Canada. And then you have the other side of the spectrum saying, who's he to say he can't lose in Canada? It'd be like me saying, I can't lose in the United States. Like, and, you know, a lot of egos involved in all that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, anyways, the whole story is Brett allegedly wouldn't do what Vince wanted. Vince felt he didn't have a choice, and it happened. Number three, I thought I heard that Owen didn't want to go. Oh, down the zip line. But Vince made him. Mitch says no. This is my faulty memory. I'm thinking she's talking about the Blue Blazer incident where Owen died.
Yeah.
I mean, he had rehearsed it earlier in the day. He was afraid of heights. You know, I don't know if he didn't want to do it per se. It's not like that was the first time he'd done it. You know, he'd done it on shows before. There was the incident where he came down in the harness and got stuck in the aisleway type of thing, remember? I don't know. You weren't watching then. Well, there was an incident where he got stuck in the aisleway. I mean, so I don't know if he didn't want to do it per se. But, you know, obviously it wasn't a safe thing because of what happened and how it ended. Why was Brett leaving? Because Vince didn't want to honor the contract. We kind of covered that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last question is, what was the whole Brett, Sonny, Sean thing? And that was the rumor that Brett and Sonny were having an affair. And that's why Sean made the comment about Brett seeing Sonny Days in one of the promos.
Yeah, and see, that's also messed up too, because Sonny, when she came into WWE, was dating Chris Candido. They were the Bodydonnas, and he was Skip. And she starts fucking Shawn Michaels. And
she did. Yeah.
He just kind of...
By her own admission in her book, she states that. So.
And Skip just kind of sits there and takes it because he doesn't know what else to do. He's in love with her, and he doesn't want to lose his position, so he won't go in and beat the shit out of Shawn, which is kind of what he should have done. So that's just another, you know, knock in Sean's character for me at that time. And then to see him throw that in Brett's face, the kind of rest of the story is that, at that time there would be two locker rooms and places, and all the boys would be in one and Sonny would get her own locker room. And Brett finally just said, you know what, screw this. So he went and shared Sonny's locker room, and they would, you know, not be in the locker room at the same time and in decent times.
Right.
It's just like she has all – there's all this space in this room. This doesn't make any sense. So Brett and Sonny became friends, and then Sean took that into a bad place.
Right. The rumor was going around that this was happening, and – He brought it was brought up on TV during a promo, and And, you know, allegedly Brett was told, you know, Sean told Brett, you know, to imply that he was gay and queer and everything. And Brett didn't feel comfortable doing things like that because, you know, Brett, and I'm not trying to say anything negative about him by any means, but there's a lot of things I've read online or saw in shoot interviews or documentaries or books, whatever, that Brett at that time, Brett Hitman Hart wasn't a character. That was him. He truly believed in everything the Hitman stood for, and maybe that's ego. Maybe a lot of what happened with Brett was his ego got in the way of things, and that the world was shifting around him, and he wasn't shifting with it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's why he was a baby face in Canada and a heel in the United States. But, you know, he's definitely a Canadian hero, a legend in Canada. I mean, there's no doubt about that. You can't deny that.
Yeah, and I mean, you just kind of hit the nail on the head with Brett, too. Like, he wasn't going to change who he was, and he, in the, you know, his character in the ring was who he was as a person. You know, I mean, that's what attracted me to him as, you know, somebody I liked was his ethics and his moral and all that stuff was that was who he was. And my frustration that, you know, just like you said, Brett was whiny Brett at that time. Mm-hmm. It was frustrating for me because I agreed with what he was saying. Like, Stone Cold was a heel and everybody started cheering him, you know, and Shawn Michaels was a douchebag and everybody started cheering him. And Brett was the guy that was doing like the right thing and he was getting booed because he was in opposition to these guys. But I don't think he could shift. Like he wasn't going to be able to shift. And he wasn't going to be able to shift. Like, he wouldn't have fit in with the Attitude Era.
No, he wouldn't have.
I don't know how much he fit. I mean, WCW didn't go to the extents of what the Attitude Era was, but I think that's why Brett kind of got lost there, too, is the, WCW just became a bigger and bigger clusterfuck, and unless you were the guy who wanted to just take everything for yourself, then you got more and more lost in the mix, because they just had bigger and bigger stables, you know. I mean, started with NWO, that had to split into two groups, and they just kept adding people until it was almost the whole fucking organization.
And WCW didn't know what to do with Bret Hart from the beginning.
No.
And Bret Hart's run in WCW was definitely marred by, you know, his first match coming in, he overturns the Sting Hogan match where, you know, there was no fast count. Like, Nick Patrick did not count fast, so that makes Brett kind of look stupid, and then he's like the referee, and then when he finally does wrestle, you know, he gets put into a feud with Booker T over the TV title, and I'll never forget the pay-per-view. The match they had in the pay-per-view was a good match, but they show Brett the belt, and Brett just kind of looks at it, and he kind of like smirks like, oh well, you know what I mean? Like, and I don't blame him in this aspect. You know, he comes in, he was just their world champion. He was blatantly screwed out of the title, and they bring him in and they put him in a feud for the lowest ranked title on the card. I mean, okay, yeah, they put the U.S. title on him eventually, and that was a little bit better of a feud. But they shouldn't have put him with the TV title. If they just want to have a match with Booker T, have him have a match with Booker T. They had a good match. Bret Hart's best matches in WCW were his two matches against Chris Benoit. The Owen tribute match and then the finals of the Mayhem tournament where he won the vacant world title. Which obviously just 2 months later he was out of wrestling practically. But the other thing that marred the WCW run of Bret Hart was, you know, he took a lot of time off after Owen died. He has a feud with Goldberg where he gets speared and he quits WCW. And it's just continuing that whiny character, except now he's not a babyface in Canada and a heel in the United States. He's just a whiner, you know? And he got some redemption with that tournament where he won the title. And he had that great celebration in the ring. The match was in Canada and in Toronto, and the great celebration with his family and everything. And then do you remember where he went out of that?
I don't remember any of this stuff. I didn't watch any of it.
Oh, okay. So coming out of that, they turned him heel and had him join the NWO.
Yeah, of course they did. That was WCW just, I mean, what the NWO stuff is what made them gain all that success and made them be able to overtake the WWE, but it's one of those things where it's not sustainable, and they never made it sustainable. They just kept on making it bigger and bigger, and part of the reason it was successful is they gave these guys everything they wanted at the beginning, but that runs everything into the ground at some point. And I mean, that's why everything you just said is the guys who were in power and like had all this sway, all they wanted was for themselves. They didn't want what was best for the company, what was best for business. They wanted everything for themselves, and it destroyed the company.
Yeah.
And they deserve to be destroyed running it like that. You know, I mean, there's Bischoff is such an interesting character. There's like so many great things that he did, but he made and ruined WCW with like the same moves. And he was just as guilty as anybody is of, you know, making himself more and more grandiose as it went on. It was just a weird thing. I mean, they made David Arquette the fucking champion. Come on.
Well, to go into it a little bit more, at Starrcade, where he got the kick in the head, Bret Hart had Goldberg in the sharpshooter, and the special referee in that match was Roddy Piper. And Roddy Piper called for the bell and walked out of the match when Bret Hart had Goldberg in the sharpshooter. Goldberg never submitted, and no winner was ever declared. And so Hart vacated the title the next night, and then they had a match, you know, to determine who was going to be the world champion to fill the vacant title. And that's when Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, and Jeff Jarrett all came out and attacked Goldberg. And yeah, that was your new NWO. And they called themselves NWO 2000. It was Bret Hart, Jeff Jarrett, Scott Hall, and Kevin Nash.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And then his final – and then he was a heel. And then his final match in WCW was against Terry Funk in a non-title match that ended in a no contest in a hardcore rules match on Thunder. So
when did Goldberg kick him in the head in the scheme of all this?
The Starrcade match.
So Brett kept going for a while after that.
Yeah, he wrestled Terry Funk and Thunder. Then he wrestled – okay, so after joining the NWO, he then wrestles Kevin Nash for the title on the January 10th Nitro, and that also ends in a no contest. And then before the sold-out pay-per-view in January, that's when he had to relinquish the title.
So jumping way back to the Survivor Series 97 card and all those people I talked about that were involved in there, and so much stuff that we've seen over time. So Vince McMahon is obviously a genius in so many ways. And I do not think he is a genius for talent across the board. You look at, you know, they have periods like this where they have guys that have stuff there, mm-hmm. and he's pushing so hard all of these guys that got fucking nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, you know, you look at this dearth of bodies that so much of it is useless, and you know, you see the seeds of stuff that grows out of it. But, I mean, we even know that some of the things that became great things he was against or didn't see it. Like Austin 316 making those shirts, he didn't see it.
Yep.
He thought that was stupid. And, you know, Steve Austin made that character, but making those damn shirts just made it, like, so easy to catch fire because it was something that everybody wanted. And when everybody wants that and everybody gets that and you see that everywhere, you just buy into it, you know? So I don't know. Vince is an interesting character, but, I mean – you know, especially over the last, I don't know, 5 years, maybe we'll say, you know, we've seen an era where it really felt like Triple H and what he was doing with NXT was starting to come up and like make an impact in the main card. Yep. And now it's like, you know, one too many NXT guys get hurt when they're trying to push him. And Vince goes, nope, we're going back to the same old shit. And that's what they do. They go back to the same old stuff, trying to push guys that nobody wants to get behind because they don't have the ability to sell. Well,
wrestling is a very fickle lady sometimes. And unfortunately, WWE they're not the only thing in town, but they're the most easily accessible thing in town. And to the general masses, maybe they like what they're seeing, but everybody I knows that I know, they still watch it because it's wrestling and they love wrestling. But they prefer like to watch NXT or indie shows or New Japan Pro Wrestling, which is absolutely killing it right now. Or even some people's preferred flavor is Impact Wrestling. But Vince McMahon's been around for since 83 he bought the company, or 82 he bought the company from his dad. So what's that, 35 years? So I don't see him not being around. You know, I don't see them going out of business anytime soon. So it's almost like we have to grin and bear it until we get our next phase of whatever it's going to be. Yeah. I just, you know.
That's what happens. I mean, you know, you can complain and there are going to be downtimes where stuff does need to change and improve. But, you know, I mean, they've been surviving and successful for so long. And, you know, the times are going to ebb and flow. And at some point, Vince is going to step out of being in control of stuff. And it may not be until he passes away, which will be a sad way to have the change. Because as much as we may want change in the product right now, I don't think anybody would say that they want Vince McMahon, who is the cause of this being so available to us anyways, to, you know, to die.
I mean, let's face it. If it wasn't for Vince McMahon and the WWE, we wouldn't have a big independent scene. We wouldn't have TNA. We wouldn't have a lot of – New Japan would not be breaking waves in the U.S. market. Ring of Honor would not be – you know, like – I honestly feel like if it wasn't for what they've done and how they've managed to keep wrestling in the limelight like they have, you wouldn't have all these other promotions still running.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, you would still have wrestling, but it would be not as good as what we have right now.
Yeah, that's why you got to kind of take the good with the bad and, you know, get what positives there are out of what there is to watch. I mean, just like watching this 97 Survivor Series, there was so much that just wasn't really worth it in it, but there's at least some stuff that is, and there's interesting seeds to see in there. You know, but then you get the stuff that you don't expect. Like, you know, for me, one of my high moments since I started watching wrestling again was seeing Daniel Bryan, what he did at WrestleMania 30 was just amazing, and the story that was over the course of a year or more was just amazing. And you know, now over the last few years, you know, as much as we complain about what we have right now, we had Kevin Owens and AJ Styles as the two champions for a good period of time there.
Yep.
You know, Finn Balor was the first champion, beating Seth Rollins.
Universal champion. Yep.
Yeah, first Universal champion, and so it goes from him to Kevin Owens, and yeah, it's gone back to business as usual for now. I mean, look at all the great things that have happened.
Yep.
And I don't, you know, I don't watch the TV cause I don't have cable. And I don't have enough time to try to like scratch stuff up and watch it all. But you know, we have all those guys are still there and now we've got Shinsuke is up there and you know, if they utilize what they have at some point, they got to start utilizing that stuff and we can,
oh, you know, look what we have in the women's division now. We don't have divas and mud pit matches and bra and panties matches. And I'm not saying that doesn't have its place. It's the same thing with hardcore wrestling or death matches or whatever. I mean, everyone likes their own flavor. But, you know, I like women's wrestling. I like to see women who actually take it seriously and go out there and wrestle. I don't want to see models prancing around out there and skimpiness. I mean, if that's what I want, then I can specifically go look for that. But when, you know, when I'm watching a pay-per-view with my kids, I want to see, you know, wrestling.
Yeah.
And at least we have that now. You know, the women's division is a women's division. It's the Divas crap is gone.
Yep. No butterfly belt.
Very happy about that. I mean, we had a glowing belt for a while, which was fucking dumb. But I just, you know, if you want to talk about Bret Hart, you know, Bret Hart left the WWE when it became a TV-14 world that he didn't fit into. And he came back to the WWE when it was a TV, you know, when it was a PG-13 world or TV-PG world that he did fit into. you know, and I'm grateful for the last run we had with Bret Hart, you know, in the WWE. He definitely wasn't the Bret Hart of old, but, you know, we got to see him.
Yeah, you got to see the character of old and not the conflict with just what the status quo is, you know, going on around him. So, and yeah, that's really, you know, you look at everything and the big problem, the reason that everything just didn't feel right that last year or so is that everything had changed around him already. And, you know, it just.
The whole company. The company as a whole went in a direction that he wasn't ready to go in.
Yeah.
And a lot of people point at Bret and the screw job as the downfall of the Hart family in wrestling. Not a lot of people. I've read that, yeah. Because if you think about it, you know, Davey and Jim left and went to the WCW. And that's when Davey Boy broke his back in the ring, damaged his back, and then became very, very addicted to drugs and eventually went back to the WWE, but that's kind of what cost him his life. You know, Neidhart after WCW pretty much didn't have a career anymore in wrestling other than the independents, but he wasn't on the big screen scene anymore. And then, you know, Owen, obviously what happened with Owen just a year and a half later, you know, when his tragic death. It's
a sad story. The only wrestling family story that is more sad than that is the story of the Von Erichs.
Yeah.
I can't think of any other one where there's a wrestling family with so much ability, so much prestige, such a big place that has had just such a precipitous downfall.
Tragedy. Yeah. 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 Really, the Von Erichs definitely do trump the Harts.
Yeah, and all it took was all of them killing themselves. God.
Jesus. Yeah, I know, right? But it's just, because Bret came back, when he first came back for the Hall of Fame, and was it 2006? That was awesome. Like, and he came in, he didn't appear at WrestleMania, he didn't do anything else. He just, you know, he came in the Hall of Fame, he went out there and he basically said he did this for his fans. And I liked his speech. I loved how he just say, hey, you know, like I'm okay. You don't have to worry about me. I'm okay. And it was heart. Yeah. I got emotional about it, if you will. And then he agreed to do the DVD, you know, the best there is, was, and ever will be. So that was awesome. You know, actually, that was before the Hall of Fame. You know, he agreed to do the DVD for his fans. He agreed to do the Hall of Fame for his fans. He wouldn't take any money from WWE on it, you know. And then eventually, you know, that famous January 4th, 2010, Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart in the ring together. It was awesome. It was awesome seeing Bret back on TV. So, if you haven't watched Wrestling with Shadows, you definitely should. You should get if you can find the DVD, there's like a two-disc DVD set. That's the one I have, and it has a bonus documentary on there about Owen Hart, and it's got additional footage, and it's like a 10th anniversary edition, I think it is. It's got additional footage and an additional interview and how things have changed. So definitely check out Wrestling with Shadows if you haven't seen it. I mean, did you watch that when it first came out?
I don't think it was when it first came out, but I did watch it because it was on Netflix.
Yeah.
I'll have to borrow that from you, though, so I could watch that additional content, though, because I have not seen that.
When that first came out, I actually got it on VHS. That's how long ago it was, because it came out in 97. It came out in 98. I got that on VHS, and it was amazing because we got Beyond the Mat after that. But just the fact that was the other thing that added to the is, you know, this must be a work, is because of the documentary that was being done on Bret, and it captured everything it did. I mean, I'm sure the documentary would have been good no matter what, but the fact that, you know, they followed his last year in the WWE and everything that happened, and then the whole screw job and the initial post screw job stuff. I mean, it was amazing. It was a view of wrestling that, as a fan, I couldn't believe I was actually watching. So it was phenomenal. WWE has since done a good documentary. They did the Bret Hart DVD. They did another Bret Hart DVD, unreleased matches, like the Dungeon Collection, they called it. They did a Bret vs. Shawn DVD where they actually do a sit down talking to both of them, talking about and showing different matches that, you know, the Rockers against the Hart Foundation, and then Bret and Shawn's singles matches. I mean, a lot of people forget they wrestled that Survivor Series in 95 for the title.
Mm-hmm.
Was it 95? Hold on. No. 94. I think they wrestled Survivor Series 94 for the title when Shawn was the Intercontinental Champion. And then they've done the Hart Family release, which is really good. If you haven't seen it, you should definitely check that one out. And then they recently did an Owen Hart release, which they hadn't done anything with Owen for a long time, I think because of Martha. And Owen, I think, needs to go into the Hall of Fame, and maybe someday he will. But, yeah. Yeah. So before we conclude this Bret Hart heavy episode, I want to touch on something that happened this morning that I think is sad, but the man was 91 years old, so it's not like he didn't have a good life. But the voice of Memphis wrestling, Lance Russell, passed away this morning, October the 3rd. And if you don't know who Lance Russell is, I feel bad for you if you're a wrestling fan, because he started calling wrestling in Memphis territory in 1959. And yeah, for the local TV. And every week, him and Dave Brown, they were on TV for over 20 years together, calling Memphis Wrestling every Saturday morning, a 90-minute show that they did. And he is the voice. I mean, if you watch any of that old footage or that Andy Kaufman stuff, you know Lance's voice. It's so recognizable. I had the pleasure of meeting him in 2009 at NW Legends Fans Fest in Charlotte, North Carolina. And we chatted in the lobby about Memphis wrestling and everything. And he was just such a great person to talk to. And he was a great guy. And, the guy called wrestling for almost 40 years. And he should have been the guy to induct Jerry Lawler into the Hall of Fame. That's who Jerry Lawler wanted to induct him into the Hall of Fame. But anyhow, what do you do? But yeah, so that's that. Anything else you want to add, Paul?
I don't think so. I think we talked about that all pretty thoroughly. It's been kind of weird. I was going back and trying to kind of look at what Bret Hart did with the WWE when he got into the championship picture. And he won the belt from Ric Flair at a house show.
And yes,
I don't even know if that's on the network. I tried to find it one night and couldn't find it.
I believe it's on. I mean, I believe you might be able to find it on an episode of Primetime Wrestling. I think they might have aired it, but I don't know if that's. I don't think Primetime, I think, ends in 1989. So I know it aired on Primetime at one point. It was on a home video at one point. I don't even know if – I'm trying to think. I know it's been released on a DVD recently, one of the newer DVDs. I'm just trying to think of which one it was. But anyways, yeah, he won the title from Flair, house show.
So you won it at a house show, which is, you know, kind of hiding it away a little bit. And then he was the champion for a while, and then he lost it to Yokozuna at the Royal Rumble in a match where, you know, he got screwed to lose it by outside interference. And then, like, the only big spectacle moment of his career before, like, he got into just all that kind of griminess that we were talking about towards the end was at WrestleMania 10 when he won the championship back.
Well, I think the better match on the show was him against Owen for the first time.
Well, I'm not talking about match quality. I'm talking about Spotlight.
Okay.
He won the championship in the Spotlight at WrestleMania
10.
And, you know, after that, like every other time he won it, it was getting into that kind of later phase of his career at WWE where it was all starting to get muddled. You know, it was like
he that beat
was the pinnacle of Bret Hart being Bret Hart at the right time,
yeah,
and getting the spotlight. And
I don't know, looking back,
it was a little weird to see only kind of one real bright spotlight of him as champion like that.
He beat Kevin Nash at Survivor Series and got beat up after. But he was the champion. So he beat Kevin Nash at Survivor Series in 95 for the belt. And then he – because he had lost the title to Bob Backlund, if you remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kevin Nash won the belt, held it for like a year. He beat Kevin Nash for the title. And then he held that going into losing it to Shawn Michaels. And then when he won the belt back, it was that Fatal 4 match they had at the pay-per-view. And then the very next night, he lost it to Sid. And then he won the belt back at SummerSlam when Shawn Michaels hit Undertaker with the title.
That was a great way they did that, too. They did that well.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess his biggest shining moment of winning the title was WrestleMania 10. I mean, of his five championship reigns, that was the most glamorized one.
Yeah, that was still my favorite WrestleMania I ever remember watching. The only one that I think is up there with it is WrestleMania 30, with you know, seeing the story with Daniel Bryan and everything. But yeah, that one, I mean, there were a lot of good matches on that WrestleMania too. There was the ladder match with Shawn and Razor.
That was an excellent match.
The match you mentioned with him and Owen.
Fantastic match. Luger and Yokozuna was meh.
I was just going to joke how great that match was, and you beat me to calling it the shit that it was.
Yeah, it was meh. You know, Leilani Kai wrestled Alundra Blaze on there. That was okay. Hey, speaking of Alundra Blaze, did you watch the documentary on WWE Network Trailblazer, the Alundra Blaze story?
I haven't watched it yet, but I know it's on there, and I've seen you guys talking about it.
You need to watch it. It is fantastic. That's still a hard push for me. For everyone else that hasn't watched it yet, you need to watch it. It's fantastic.
Yeah, so I think that's it.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks for joining me this week, Paul, so we can chat up some Bret Hart action. Hey, wait, before we go, Paul, you met Bret Hart.
Yeah.
I was with you. It was at a Big Time Wrestling show here in Augusta. How'd that treat you?
That was great. I am not the type of person who usually gets, you know, choked up around celebrities or stuff like that. You know, like, we met a bunch of cool wrestlers that day, a lot of guys that I knew, grew up watching and stuff like that. Yeah. And it's like, I didn't really have a lot to say to most of them, but, you know, but you did the talking, so I don't really have to worry about that. But, man, Bret Hart, I definitely got that, you know, starstruck feeling. Because he just, you know, like I said, he was the biggest person I was a fan of, period, for my young life. There aren't many other people that that are up there in my esteem like he is, where when I meet them, like, it, you just, sometimes you meet somebody and they mean so much to you in so many different ways that you just don't know how to express anything. I think that kind of sums it up. So yeah. I got his autograph. I bought his book again because I had had it before. But when we moved from California to Maine, we got rid of a lot of stuff. And I was like, ah, whatever. It's just a book.
Yeah.
So I bought it again, had him sign it, and I had him make it out to me and Sam because that was
when – I remember that now.
I don't even think Sam was born then. I think that was before he was born. Either that or he was less than a year old.
No, that was, I think he was less than a year old.
Okay. I knew it was one or the other.
And it was your first wrestling show you'd gone to in a long time as well, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I had been to three wrestling shows before that, and it was in the 90s. And to give you a time frame for it, Undertaker was wrestling Mankind, and that was like at the beginning of their first feud when Mankind came into WWF. It was all around that time, within a few years, you know, a few years of that time. I went to a show in Anaheim, and I don't remember a lot of it, but, like, I remember that match specifically. And then I went to two times that WCW came to the Lancaster, California Fairgrounds, the Antelope Valley Fairgrounds, my little hometown, Those were fun. Like, I remember those pretty fondly, too. It was just so weird, though, being like, what the hell is WCW doing coming to freaking Lancaster? But, yeah, I'll always remember. I couldn't tell you very many specifics about them. I know I saw Hacksaw at least one of them. Hulk Hogan was at neither. It was, yeah, I have fond memories of those, definitely. So this was the first time I had been to a wrestling show since then. And it was, like, not only did they have a lot of legends of wrestling there, which was cool for me, but they had some good matches, too. And one of the biggest surprises to me was seeing Bushwhacker Luke really work, man.
Yeah, Bushwhacker Luke against Cameron Matthews. I too, was kind of disappointed because I'm a big Cameron Matthews fan at that time. And then to see, oh, they put him with Luke, this is going to suck. And then it was actually very surprisingly a good match.
Yeah, that was a big surprise because I wouldn't have expected that because Luke, he was up there in age. That was a lot of fun. But yeah, meeting Brett was real special. Just out of like in any kind of entertainment, there aren't many people that I would really get choked up meeting. Bret Hart was one of them. But I asked him to make that to me and my son, and he didn't say much. He was fairly quiet, but yeah, he shook my hand and said, "Good luck with your son." And it's such a small thing, but like that's just something that'll always be a special memory for me, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was a decent day of wrestling. And sometimes you meet your heroes and you get disappointed. And that's definitely not the case with the Hitman.
Yeah.
Because he is a very, what we saw as the Hitman, like we talked about earlier, his morality of everything, that's who he is. From what we've seen, in our interactions with him. So
yeah.
Anyhow, cool. All right. Well, again, thanks, Paul. You can feel free if you have any questions, comments, or give us your opinions on Bret Hart and the whole Montreal Screwjob and what you thought it was. You can reach us on the Twitter. I'm at SuperstarML. You say your own, Paul, on the show.
I'm very tired. That's why I didn't respond. I am at Who's Paul.
Don't forget you can reach out to Aaron at Aaron S. Bell, Ronnie's Ron Bar 316. The show is Thousand Holds Pod. Yep, I did that right. And then on Facebook, Podcast of Thousand Holds. So thanks.